Good morning. In this section of scripture, in the book of Colossians, there are six relationships that are described. And the last Sunday of October, we talked about three of them, and today we'll finish the final three. But we'll have a brief review of where we've been, and then we'll get on with new material for today. Essentially, while there are six relationships described, they deal with three subjects: marriage, family, and career. Just like we can pick up bad ideas from the world in which we live, the first century Christians had the same problem. And it's easier to talk about their problems than it is about ours. So let's start there. There were two pagan ideas that were circulating in the first century relative to where the book of Colossians was written to, the place of Colossae. One of the ideas was they believed there was a God, but that there was a disconnect between God in heaven and his involvement in the earth. There was the idea that there is a God, but he really doesn't have anything to do with life on the earth. Now, these six relationships we're going to talk about, where are they? Well, they're on the earth. So just because there were people talking about God isn't interested in what's going on in the earth, we really don't care what people think. God has something to say about what life is to be on the earth, and these six relationships reflect that. So while they believe there was a disconnect, that isn't true. The second bad idea was that only a small group of people understood spiritual things, and so they were kind of elitists. Have you ever been treated by somebody who, they didn't say this, but what they said meant, you know, you're so stupid you'd never understand this, so just trust me that I know what I'm doing. And my response to that is, if you really know what you're talking about, you can explain it to me. Because I got out of bed this morning, I took a shower, and I dressed, and I drove a car down to Clarion. So I can understand some things. So tell me, really. I don't buy into this elitist mentality. And if you read the whole book of Colossians, you know, over and over again, the Apostle Paul uses the expression that we have complete understanding of things. We have understanding of things. We have understanding of things. You're not stupid. You can understand things. And so, despite the fact that the attitude was only a select few could understand things, I don't buy it. There is no disconnect between heaven and earth. God is involved with life on the earth, and we can understand the things he's interested in explaining to us. We can get it, so to speak. What is said about these relationships is based on all the information that came up to this point. The book began by explaining what happens to a person when they trust Christ as their Savior. Well, some of the things are the basis of their trust is transferred to Christ. They have a new life. Another thing that's established before these relationships are discussed is who Jesus Christ is. He's God's divine Son, he's the Creator, and he's the Redeemer. So given these kinds of things, then it goes on to say that the objective of the ministry is that we know the presence of the indwelling Christ. Christ in you, the hope of glory. So having said that, we get down to these six relationships. And oftentimes, I've heard people who own businesses joke about people who come for a job interview. And they don't seem to want to understand any of the responsibilities that they'll have. They just want to know about the benefits. How much time will I have off? And will I have a car, a place to park my car, a space just for me? You know, all the benefits of things. Will I have insurance? And will I have retirement? Stuff like that. But then don't seem too concerned about their responsibilities. This passage of Scripture talks about our responsibilities and not about our rights and expectations. And it also puts together the wonderful truth that good theology is related to life. Good thinking about God is important. Before God sent Moses on his great mission to conclude his life of leading the children of Israel out of Egypt and through the wilderness wandering in the promised land, before any of that happened, Moses met God, or God met Moses, at the burning bush. And there were a number of things that were established about who God is. Moses needed to understand who God is if he was going to fulfill his mission. So good theology and life just fit very, very well together. Our scripture reading is from Colossians, beginning at chapter 3, verse 18, through the first verse of chapter 4. Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when their eye is on you and to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for men. Since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward, it is the Lord Christ you are serving. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for his wrong, and there is no favoritism. Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven. This section of Scripture talks about what to do. It doesn't talk about what to expect. And another way of putting it is, this is about our duties and responsibilities, not about our rights. The world in which we live is, for the most part, taken up with our rights, not with what my responsibilities are. We need to change our focus. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of, here are the first three we've dealt with before, a wife's involvement, a wife's intentional participation in her husband's life, a husband's selfless love, and a child's active obedience. The last three, which we'll look at more closely, a father's deliberate nurturing of his children, an employee's conscientious work, and an employer's adequate compensation. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of a wife's intentional participation. Now, usually when the word submission is said with regard to a wife, people bristle. And I have a friend I've referred to frequently who's passed away. But if Bob heard something that kind of ground his gears, he'd start, before he made a sound, he'd start to twist his face up and his vocal cords would tighten, I'm guessing. And then what would come out of his mouth was, "What?" And you knew that he heard something that was not squaring with what he thought was reality. So when people talk about this, submit, some people bristle at that. The word submit could be translated a voluntary yielding. And the word voluntary is important because it's in the middle voice. It's something that the wife is told to do, but she has a choice about this. Now, this week, I guess it was yesterday, in the Quarry Journal, there's a guy pictured on the front page of the paper with a beautiful truck. It's just a fantastic looking piece of equipment. And next to it, he's pictured with his wife. He has been named the National Truck Driver of the Year by a truck driving organization. And this is a great honor. There's a nice article on the front page and it goes into deeper things. One of the things he says is that he couldn't do this, he couldn't do what he does without the support of his wife. When I met Pam at a basketball game in 1965 at Nyack College, we established a relationship that is present right up to today. We never had an on-again, off-again thing. That was the start of it, and it's continued since then. She bought in to what I was doing with my life. I went off to seminary without her. She stayed at Nyack College and completed her degree. She was the first graduate in the elementary education program. And she couldn't graduate until January, the next January, after I got my degree in the previous May or June. She had to stay on. There was no way I was going to interrupt her education. Her parents had sacrificed greatly to provide her with an education. I had watched other students get married and the wife ended her academic career. I wouldn't do that. She bought into what I was doing voluntarily. She agreed with this. We got married after my first year in seminary. She has helped me my whole life voluntarily. I didn't demand it. I didn't be insistent about it. She bought into what I was doing voluntarily, working with me to facilitate what I was doing. In just a minute, I'll tell you how I've helped her. This is in the middle voice, which we don't talk this way in English, but it means that the wife has some choices to make about how she's going to live. She chose to cooperate. This guy, who's the truck driver, said he couldn't do what he does without the support of his wife. And he described a little bit about how they work together. Is this countercultural about talking about a wife? Some people will say she's given up her life, she has no life, she has blah, 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 and really runs it down. The fact is, this is something that the scriptures talk about as a biblical principle, and you'll see the way the whole thing works out in just a minute. Who could do something like this? A wife who knows the Lord. This begins by talking about living this way and as pleasing the Lord. Who am I living for? Who is my wife living for? Duties define and develop our character. We develop as people by fulfilling our responsibilities. People who don't fulfill their responsibilities, not only don't fulfill their responsibilities, they don't grow as people. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of a husband's selfless love. Verse 19 tells husbands to love their wives. The Ephesians 5 passage, you're familiar with, it talks about how Christ is the model for how a husband is to treat his wife. How does Jesus treat us? How has he invested himself in our spiritual redemption? And how ought we to model his behavior in enhancing the life of our wife? It's that agape love. It's in the imperative mood. I don't have any choice about it. God tells me to do it, and I agree with him. This is something I need to do. Now, just like my wife has helped me and helps me right up to this point, the way we do things, the way we work together, we're a team. And she bought in to the kinds of things I was doing. When I was in seminary, she typed all my term papers. Now, one of the reasons she did that was I can type, I could have done it. But she got a seminary education too. And if it didn't make sense to her, it wouldn't make sense to my professor. So she was my proofreader. She is my proofreader to this day. And so she got an education as well as I got an education. When she was over 50, she was trained as an elementary school teacher. She was going to go back and teach school. And she was told, we don't want you. You're too expensive. You know too much. You're too good at what you do. We're trying to get rid of people like you. It doesn't sound very nice, does it? But we had friends who were principals, and there was no future for her in education. So she decided she was going to be a chiropractor. There were three things when I met Pam she was never going to do. And she told me this early on. Never marry a preacher. Never homeschool. She thought that was the craziest thing anybody would do. And never go to a chiropractor. She married me. She homeschooled our boys. And she not only went to a chiropractor, she became a chiropractor. So I really don't care what people say they're going to do or not do. Time will tell. We'll find out. So anyway, we looked into this, even talked with the elders of the church. She would live for 2 years and 7 months, 120 miles away. And she'd come home on the weekends and then go back for the next week of school. They never really had a break between the terms. It might be a couple days off and then you go right back, so it's year round. And then after the 2 years, 7 months, there's a externship where she's working under supervision. I bought into that. One day, I was early in our marriage, I thought, you know, someday I'm going to see her dad, Dutch Sickler, in heaven. And I'm going to maybe be asked by him, how did you treat my daughter? How did you take care of her? And then I thought, Dutch isn't the problem. I'm going to face the Lord someday. She's his child. How have I treated her? Have I done things that enhance her life? Or have I taken advantage of her? I thought when we were really young, newly married, I had friends who had, first of all, if you have Jeep with chrome rims on, that's okay. I'm not knocking it. But I had friends who had Jeeps with chrome rims on and all kind of fancy stuff on their vehicles and stuff. But they never had any money to send their wife to a ladies' retreat. I thought that was unwise. I didn't have a Jeep with chrome rims, or I didn't have a fancy car. If I had a car, but I always came up with money. We always came up with money for her to go to a ladies' retreat and do things that would enhance her life and bless her life. And I supported her in her chiropractic education. And just like she helps me, I help her. We work together, we're a team. There were times I remember explaining to my sons when they were trying to put a wedge between myself and Pam that February the 27th, 1965, I met your mother at a basketball game. And after the basketball game, any gentleman would take this young lady, out for ice cream, which I did. And that was the beginning of our relationship. So don't try and put a wedge between mom and dad, because we're a team. Is this idea of a husband investing his life in the life of his wife countercultural? Yeah, it is. You know, it's a strange thing to do. But it's a thing that God tells me to do. And that for sources of information on my relationships, all my relationships, or my gender, anything, I don't look to the world to tell me what to do. I look at the scriptures to tell me what to do. And if I'm siding with God on how things are to be done, I'm in good company. Who could live this way as a man, as a husband? Well, a man who knew Christ, the indwelling presence of Christ, Christ in me, the hope of glory, a man who had embraced the gospel and had Christ change his life. That's who could do this. I'm not trying to put this on the world. I'm not trying to put this on people who don't know the Lord. Their first problem is they need to find Christ as their Savior and get their spiritual estate in order. And once the spiritual estate's in order, God will tell us how to live, which is what we're talking about here. Duties develop our character. When a man lives sacrificially to honor the Lord in his marriage, his life grows and his purposes in life become clearer. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of a child's active obedience. One of the things that a parent is trying to do, this letter was read in church, just like we read it this morning. It was read when the Colossian church got together. So kids heard this, teenagers heard it, younger children, whoever was there heard it. But this is as much written to a parent to know that one of the responsibilities of a parent is to train children, to teach them what the standards are and the way behavior is to be conducted. I run into people all the time who have a problem following directions or don't want to really do what their boss or their supervisor told them to do. And maybe some of this stuff goes back to childhood where they're not really taught the way to do things or how to do things. When I was growing up, I worked in a garage in Enola at Chauver's Esso. It's a gas station. And if you'd worked under the hood of a car when it was being serviced, there's a guy down in the pit doing the underside, and you're under the hood. Right next to where the car's parked is a cabinet with grease rags on the top, and wrenches are laid in there. When the wrench is in your hand and you're working with it, that's where it belongs. But when it's not in your hand, it goes on that tabletop with the grease rags on. So that any time a question is had about those tools, there are either one or two places. It's either in somebody's hand or it's on that table. That's a life lesson. You put stuff back. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. The objective of child rearing, of nurturing a child, of helping a child accommodate to life in the earth is helping them find a level of obedience where they can comply with the rules of the house and the standards of the house. That's a parent's objective. Is this countercultural? Yeah, there's some things that we're told where the child's deciding everything and the whole world revolves around the child. That's raising a very, very selfish person. They need to find out how they fit into the family and how we work together. Who could do this? Well, a parent and children who are raised in the fear of the Lord. That's who. Duties develop us. If we want to develop a child into a responsible adult, they need to be given responsibility. One of the wonderful things of a person being raised in rural America is if they have a farm or a farmette or they have responsibilities with animals, responsibilities develop people. And it's just a wonderful thing to see children exercise responsibilities that they're taught what to do, how to do it, and they, in a sense, are self-directing in what they do. It's a wonderful blessing. I'm glad I was raised in a world where I was taught to do things. And when people lived in our home, they were taught to do things. For a year, we had a young lady from Jamaica live in our house, in our home, as a family, for her last year of high school. And she went on to get a college degree and to become a medical doctor. And so one day I called her, "How you doing?" "Fine, I just finished mowing my lawn." And I said, where'd you learn to do that?" She said, "You taught me." I will bet she is the only doctor on her street with that nice house who mowed their own lawn. But she was proud of that. I just finished mowing my lawn. Who taught you that? You did. I knew the answer to the question, but I wanted her to be given the freedom to brag about it, and then for me to brag about it, that it was wonderful having her with us, and she knew how to do that. So that there are many forces at work in the nurturing of children. It has an effect on mom and dad, and it has an effect on the child, and we work together in that. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of a wife's intentional participation in the life of her husband, a husband's selfless love, investing his life in the nurturing of his wife, and a child's active obedience. Those are the first three. The next three, a father's deliberate nurturing, and an employee's conscientious work, and an employer's adequate compensation. We'll talk about those three. Responsibility of a father's deliberate nurturing. Now, I watched some news, but I don't know that I've ever heard in the mainstream media any discussion or talk about how dads are to nurture their children. The only people talk about that are people like James Dobson or Family Life or whatever. Christians talk about that, but the world doesn't talk about that. And there are three Bible translations here I'm referring to. The New International Version, the King James, and then those last three initials are mine. I tried to put this in a little bit of a paraphrase, so you won't find that anywhere if you look it up. It's just me. In the Greek text, there are three words used to describe a father's responsibility. The King James uses three words, and the New International Version tries to smooth it out and explain it, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just calling attention to these things. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. So there you have three words in the Greek and in the King James. Don't provoke them to anger, or they'll get discouraged. The New International uses two words. Fathers, don't embitter your children, or they will become discouraged. It puts two words together in making the embittering thing. Now, I put a little minus sign there saying what a dad shouldn't do. Dad, don't irritate your children and pour anger into their lives. This will cause them to lose heart and be discouraged. So that's telling a dad, that's telling me as a dad, what I shouldn't do. Don't do that. When I was hauling, the other year, a lady gave me a coffee cup. During October, which is like Pastor Appreciation Month or something. Anyway, she gave me this coffee cup. And on the side of it, it says something like, caution, pastor, you may become an example. So it's warning people, caution. There's a pastor here. You might become an illustration or an example. I heard people talk to people in their family in a way that was just unbelievable. Of men who spoke very disparagingly about their wife, to their wife in front of me when I was delivering water and oil. This is bad. When we speak in a disparaging way, it damages people, it hurts people. Not just their quote-unquote feelings, but it does big damage. So we don't want to damage our kids by pouring anger into them and causing them to be discouraged. Putting it in the positive, dad, deliberately nurture the inner life of your child so their driving force is love that they get from you and not anger and bitterness. So nurture them so that their driving force becomes love and not bitterness. Isn't this counterculture? Well, in the first century, fathers could do anything they wanted to their children. They could sell them, they could trade them, they could kill them, anything, brutalize, whatever. Anything went. Well, today, how are children treated? The news is just full of all kinds of inappropriate things that are done to children. In fact, you'll have to search far and wide to find any positive things in the media said about dads in developing and nurturing and caring for their children so that they become responsible adults. But the scriptures give us that responsibility. One of the fun things of getting older, for me, I'm not putting this on you, but for me, is that I learned things way after they apparently happened. I was getting ready to move from one church to another church years ago, and a young man came to me and said, "I want you to know that I didn't have a very good father, and I have looked to you as a father." Just saying that brings tears to my eyes. He needed a father. And I knew after he said this, he must have been watching me about how I conducted myself. One day at the Chinese church, after I had seated Pam and myself, and we were in the chairs, they have chairs in our church, a guy told me, he says, I see the way you take care of your wife. Now, she could have walked in, she could have taken her own coat off, she could have found a seat, she could have done all this stuff. But out of respect to her, I show her to the seat, take her coat off, make sure she's comfortable. That's just the way I believe it should be done. Well, he was watching this, and that was not the way most Chinese guys treat their wife. He was watching. So we are watched. Whether you like it or not, people watch you as to how you conduct yourself and how you treat people and everything else. It's the kind of world we live in. It's the way things are. And I want to be, I don't care if it's counterculture. We live in Spartansburg. There are a lot of Amish people around there. And these Amish women are trying to have me go in the door first. And I just say to them, "You're an American, ma'am, ladies first. I don't care who they are. You're in America, ladies first. We will treat you with respect. Nobody else might, but I will." So we're back to this countercultural thing. Dads are men who nurture their children. And dads are men who invest their lives in the blessing of their wife. And these are two scriptural concepts and truths by which we live. Who could live this way as a father? People who know Christ as their Savior. That's one of the things that's repeated in here. Duties develop our character. If I want to grow as a man in my fathering role, I should behave myself in a certain way and do what I can to nurture people. And we can nurture more people than just our own children. We can pour good things into the lives of children and youth to encourage them on their way. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of an employee's conscientious work. You notice there are more verses given to explain work than anything else. And you and I know that the word work is kind of a dirty word in our culture. It's like, you know, when I'm driving a truck, I see signs everywhere. Job openings, help wanted, walk in. You don't even need to phone ahead. Just walk in for an interview. We've lost the sacredness of work in our culture, and it was systematic for a long time. A lot of things were done. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You see it everywhere. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when the eye is on you and to curry their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for their wrongs, and there is no favoritism. Slavery in the first century was rampant, and there is slavery in the world today. The approach the scriptures have to this is the preaching of the gospel and the conversion of the hearts of people, and structures set up about how people were to be treated. And in time, it was corrected. England corrected it. We had our own civil war. These things were corrected. Now, today, I'm applying this to my work as an employee. I'm employed. I have responsibilities. And I am to do those responsibilities as service to the Lord. And the Lord will reward me. Isn't this countercultural? Yes, it is. We live in a culture where people only want to do what they have to do and not one thing more. And if there's an expression that's used way too much, you hear it all the time, that's not my responsibility. That's not my responsibility. That's not my responsibility. So that I don't get off track, I wrote a list down of things I want to talk about doing good work. Here's the list. We caulk around the tops of window frames where people can't see. When I painted my house in Bowie, Maryland, and I got on a ladder and I got up to see the top of the window frames, when they were installed, nobody put caulk around them. You know why? Because nobody could see that. They caulked the bottom, but it was out of sight, out of mind. They didn't have to do it. And we lived in a nice house. And all the houses were that way. Nobody's windows were caulked on the top. We see projects through to completion. I had a friend in Washington, D.C., who investigated government fraud. Let's say we hired somebody to change that whole wall from the front to the back. And they got back there about two windows, and they were paid for the whole job, and that's all that got done. And so they'd go out and get another government contract and do it back to the doors. And then there'd be a third contract to finish the job. Well, this guy investigated government fraud. And he had an office and a grade that was very, very high. He took me to lunch one day down at the Navy base. And when he went in the gate, they asked him if he wanted an escort. And I thought, oh, man, this'd be cool. They'd get flashing lights and somebody drive a car, and wouldn't that be something? Said, no, he knows where he's going. He'll just drive it down there. He had a very high. He'd put bib overalls on, and he'd rent an old car, and he'd get down and he'd start talking to people about that wall. And he'd find it that the government had been ripped off, not once, not twice, but three times to get the job done. That's not how we do work. We complete the projects. We complete the work. We do what we're asked to do, and we do it in good fashion. We don't leave messes for other people to finish. We don't loaf in a job. If we open it, we close it. If we use a tool, we put it back. And we put it back clean so the next guy doesn't get his hands greasy. If we turn it on, we turn it off. If we empty it, we replace it. If we unlock it, we lock it back up. You put the linoleum under the threshold of the door. You don't stop the linoleum before the threshold to create a seam where dirt and stuff collects. You do it right. You put the linoleum. It irritates me. You caulk around the trim and you seal the wood with primer and paint. If you trim the top of a door or the bottom of a door, you make sure it's sealed. I pastored a church one time where when the building was new, they put these doors on the outside of the building. There were doors all over the place. And the doors were cut off at the bottom and the top and then installed, and nobody sealed them. Guess what happened to the doors? They all rotted out. Every one of them. It wasn't done right to start with. So these are just examples. You file the papers properly so when somebody needs to get them, they can find them. Your term papers are well done. You're probably not writing term papers, but when I was in college, if they said, we want a 500-word essay on this subject, there were some students who, when they got the 500 words, they put a period. Right in the middle of a sentence. Made no sense. Just, that's your 500 words. That is not the standard by which we do our work. Our work ought to be done well to honor the Lord. Recently, my boss bought two brand new Mack trucks, and they didn't have the electronic logs in, so I had to fill out paper logs. And I had to do this a couple months ago, and my boss asked me, can you do a paper log? Yeah, I do paper log. When did you do paper log last? 1968. What? Yeah. Yeah, where I worked before, we drove a limited distance. You didn't need a paper log. You needed bills of lading to prove what you were doing, but you didn't need a log. The objective of me doing the logs was so that when they got into the office, the person dealing with them could make sense of it, and it made sense, and they were to be done right. We do our work well. This is a Christian concept. Who could do this? Well, somebody who knows the Lord, because all our work is for the Lord. Everything in the world was made, well, here we go. For Him, all things were created. In Him, all things were created. Things in heaven, on the earth, visible, invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Him and for Him. This world is owned by God, and we're stewards in this world, whatever we're doing, to care for His world. And it ought to be done in a way that pleases Him and reflects well on Him. Here's a TLB means Today's Living Bible. Sometimes it's just abbreviated Living Bible, but never be lazy in your work, but serve the Lord enthusiastically. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of an employer's adequate compensation. Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven. There's a Christian approach to management. I don't know how old I was when I heard this, but I could have been 12 or 14 years old, and I worked in a coal yard just down the street from where I lived. And this man had over-the-road trucks. I remember him telling me how happy he was that his employees could have a nice pickup truck or a nice car and live in a nice house and make good money. He was happy in that. He was justifiably proud that he paid his employees well. I'll never forget that. I heard that as a kid. I think that's commendable. I think that's really the way things ought to be. So there's a Christian approach to taking care of business, and I believe that he had it very, very well. Who could live this way of being fair in compensation? Well, someone who knew Christ and who was living their life to please the Lord. Here's a summary. Healthy relationships are defined by the responsibility of a wife's intentional participation, a husband's selfless love, a child's active obedience, a father's deliberate nurturing, an employee's conscientious work, and an employer's adequate compensation. Now, every sermon should have three things, something to know. What I know from this is that marriage is the center of the social fabric. It's not my career, and it's not my family. It starts with a marriage. Now, it's last week when I was hauling freight. I had a freight train run through my brain, and this was what it gave me. If you want to make a messed up society, take these six things and turn them on their head. Instead of having a wife's active participation in her husband's life, have her be independent. and not involved, not connected. Instead of a husband sacrificially loving his wife, just be selfish and don't care for her. And instead of having children who know the rules and regulations and obey, have them be irresponsible. And instead of having a dad nurturing his children, just have him do something else. Have him get into his career and forget his kids. And as an employee, instead of being diligent and serving the Lord, do your work any way you want to. Don't be too serious about it. And if you own a business, don't take care of anybody. See what you can get out of them for as cheap as you can get. If you want to mess up a society, just turn these six things on their head. And in some cases, you can look out and you see that going on in our own society, unfortunately. I mentioned this the last time about marriage being the center. Years ago, a guy told me he had a friend who went to be interviewed down in California for a big job, and they wanted him to bring his wife along. And he took his wife along and went to this interview. And while he was being interviewed and the wife is sitting there, a lady came in and said, would you like to meet the founder of the company? And she said, oh, I'd like to. So this lady was escorted down, and this old guy who founded the company, he wanted to find out if they had a happy marriage, because he found out that his best employees were people who had a healthy marriage, and they weren't bringing all their baggage to work of being frustrated and angry and disappointed and stuff like that. The man had all the qualifications he needed for the job. He just wanted to make sure that this guy was going to be an asset to the company and not a liability. Now, people may say, you can't do that. You're not, you know, it's against the law. Well, this man owned the business, he did the business, and he took care of his people. And he wanted to know who he was investing in. And when I've been interviewed for things, the people who hired me wanted to know what they were getting. And I applaud that. Every sermon says something to believe. And what I believe is that God will tell me how to structure my view of society. My family, my marriage, my career, my work, whatever. The scriptures will tell me this. I need to know what God says. And every sermon has something to do. I've given some illustrations about I want to have a marriage-centered family. Begins with myself and my wife. And I want to fulfill my duties. The duties I exercise will develop my life. I want a life that's growing and moving in the right direction. And my duties will help do that. So I don't want to be irresponsible or careless. And the centrality of Christ in everything. It all begins with Jesus, and it all ends up with Jesus, and I want to please Jesus, and if I please the Lord, that's it. That's really what the goal and the objective is. And that brings us to the end. Ruth, it's time to sing again.